Hello and welcome to Sorry You're in My Seat, a weekly podcast that brings together three best friends on a quest to find the greatest movies of all time. This week, however, we're changing the format a little bit.
We've decided to take a couple of weeks break from our usual episodes because we've just finished season one. We're about to go into season two. So we thought a couple of weeks off just to recharge the batteries. So in between me, Aaron and James have decided we're going to take it in turns or get together as when we can. Just do shorter little episodes discussing just not so much smaller topics, would you say, but just quick, fast-paced episodes just to keep you entertained.
Yeah, we didn't want to lose the momentum of the show. We've done 52 amazing episodes. Well, we think they're amazing.
We enjoy them.
Well, actually, most of them are subpar, but we've done 52 episodes in season one, and as Sam says, yeah, a little break is needed as we kind of regroup and figure out what we want to do for season two. So, we don't want to lose that momentum. So these little episodes, kicking off this week with a hot topic.
Very, very hot topic. It could go badly.
A controversial topic. Redacted before Redacted was even a thing. We're going to discuss Mel Gibson.
Redacted before Redacted was Redacted.
That's it, Mel Gibson. We're going to look at his filmography. We're going to pick our top five Mel Gibson movies, and we are going to talk about one of Hollywood's most well-renowned bad boys.
Biggest bad boys.
Oh, and hopefully you guys will stick with it for the whole show.
I enjoy a bad boy, though. I'm not saying I agree with anything he's done, because I really don't.
No.
But I like a bad boy. Because let's be honest, if everyone was to follow suit constantly, then, I don't know, I like a bit of gossip.
Yeah.
Workplace gossip every now and then. This is bad stuff, but at the same time, it gives you something to talk about. It gives you, you know, and let's be honest, if you really look into Mel Gibson's sort of life and career, it shows his like arc through his lifestyle and how he's changed and you know, the apologies and everything he's gone through and the counseling he's had to go through because of these issues has made him a better person, better film writer, better director, better actor.
So he's a
better human being, absolutely. So he's actually a good one to talk about, even though he's been a bad boy, yeah, but not to certain redacted extents.
Yeah. I mean, we cannot clarify enough, as Sam has just said there, this is not to, we're not doing a deep dive into his criminal past or his antisocial behaviors or anything like that. We will acknowledge them. We do not condone them. We do not support them. But we will inevitably, if we're talking about Mel Gibson, we will address those at some point. But I wanted to bring this up. So when we had this idea of doing a short break, a couple of episodes, just these mini episodes, Mel Gibson's one that I've wanted to do for a while, because when I look back at what got me into film, hand on heart, Mel Gibson is the person that took me from being a fan of film when I was younger, when I was, you know, really, really young.
Early teens type thing, maybe?
Way before that.
Oh, really?
I'd say kind of, you know, maybe 11, 12. I remember watching one of the films we're going to discuss, the film Ransom, which came out in 1996. I didn't watch it in 96. I watched it a few years afterwards, but that to me was a turning point in going from loving film and loving things like, you know, He-Man and, you know, films like Star Wars and Jurassic Park and Disney to actually, holy shit.
This is deeper.
Look at that. Yeah. Like, and Ransom's a great example of that because of, if for anyone who's seen it, like there's a flip in the middle of the film. And as a young, impressionable, at the time film fan, but became a film lover, was hugely down to Mel Gibson's performance and me thinking, shit, that I was just engrossed.
There's more to it than effects and, you know, animation and stuff.
It's not just people reading the script or, you know, just getting paid to have a, you know, an amazing job. This is, you know, this is an art. This is a lifestyle. This is a, you know, and, you know, when I was watching Ransom as a younger, and I was too young to watch the film.
When I came out when you was, what, 10, 9, 10?
Yeah, it would have been just before year 9, yeah. You could have, you know, the house could have been on fire and I wasn't moving. I was gripped into this film. And there's this iconic scene we'll talk about in a bit, on a balcony. And I was blown away by it. And I was like, that's acting, you know. And then what I did was I did a bit of a deep dive into Mel Gibson's career and actually then started, this is again, like kind of when I first discovered eBay a few years later and started like getting Mel Gibson VHSs. And I had almost his whole filmography at one point.
I remember, yeah. Along with your M&M albums.
Yeah. Oh, times have changed. A lot changed after 2003. So I wanted to do this episode for a while now, and I didn't think it was the kind of thing to bring to our main show, mm-hmm. Which we try and keep light and funny, and we try and keep it silly. And I think this deserves a kind of decent chat. We do still have beers though, so we will still have a few beers as we go through this. And this is all going to boil down to, by the end of the episode, we're going to reveal the Sorry in My Seat top five Mel Gibson films. So that's what we're building up to. But as always, if you have a particular favorite, do let us know on social media. You can find us through all the appropriate channels. Sorry, You're in My Seat. Do find us, do contact us, and let us know.
Yeah, please let us know, because I genuinely believe whilst we were discussing these, you're not going to agree with us.
Yeah.
There's a biggie in there that is not in there. That yeah. I think we're going to get a lot of shit for.
So Mel Gibson's got 65 acting credits, but from the top of your head, Sam, what are some of your kind of Mel Gibson iconic performances?
You see, now, if you listen to the other episodes, Lethal Weapon, definitely. Ransom Again. I remember we become friends at like 16 years old and you were still talking about the film then and you made me watch that. Incredible. And a bit of an indie, lower budget one, Beaver, for me was...
Yeah.
I remember watching that and thinking, fuck, Mel Gibson, man, like, you are another level.
And obviously, this was after all the problems he's having.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know you're not the biggest fan, but Braveheart growing up. I remember, what's the film called? The Civil War.
Patriot.
The Patriot, sorry, yeah. Mm. I remember watching that as a kid and just being blown away by it. Mm. And it was the first time I've ever seen anyone's head get removed with a cannonball. And I remember watching that and being like, oh, no. Yeah. Oh. I absolutely loved that film. And Signs as well. Yeah, just there's so many to talk about.
Signs, yeah. Patriot, I love because of Jason Isaacs.
Yeah.
He's the most villainous English bad guy you could ever have had for that film.
Best bad guy ever.
Yeah, you know, Heath Ledger's in that film as well. That is iconic. Long, long, long film, that one. And I think that's from reading around Mel Gibson, I don't think he's as happy with the end result as I think as much of the attention that it got. I think he had issues with it. Signs, though, I love. And interestingly, Signs is a real turning point in Mel Gibson's career as well, where I remember reading around this, him saying that he was the oldest on set.
Massively,
and he was working the hardest out of all of them. And it was actually M. Night Shyamalan come up to him and it was like, it's modern filmmaking. You do not have to do everything that you're doing. And I remember reading around Mel Gibson where he described it as a turning point in his career where he really kind of thought, I don't want to be the movie star anymore. I want to be a filmmaker. I want to be a storyteller. I want to be an actor, but I don't want to be the star anymore.
And look at some of the stories he's told since. Yeah. He has become that man.
Yeah. So let's have a look at Mel Gibson's career life then before we go into some of his films and start kind of going into our top five. So Mel Gibson's full name.
So that'd be Mel Column Seal Gerard Gibson.
It's the Column Seal. I didn't know how you pronounce. Mel Gibson. Mel Column Seal Gerard Gibson was born on January 3rd, 1956 in Peekskill, New York, USA, and is the sixth of 11 children.
That is crazy, isn't it?
Imagine that.
And he really sort of made up for that when he started having kids himself.
Yeah, don't believe in contraception, kids. Like, let's go for it.
I've got to say, though, I always thought he was Australian.
So this is a difficult one, isn't it? So his mum's from Irish descent. His dad is an American-born Irishman. From an Irish family, sorry. He's American-born Irish. His grandparents settled in Australia. He was born in America. And by the age of, was it 10? He moved over to Australia. Do you know why they moved over to Australia?
No.
It was because the dad was worried that some of the children might get drafted into the Vietnamese War.
Oh, right, okay.
So they picked up and they moved over to where Mel Gibson's paternal grandmother was living just outside Sydney,
wasn't it?
She's an opera singer. And then from the age of 12, and I'm pretty certain he has gone on record to say he's dual nationality in the purest sense.
Yes.
He's rooted in Australia. He's won, and a lot of his accolades are as an Australian actor.
His earlier stuff was all Australian.
Yeah. I mean, his earliest film, one of his first films, they had to dub his accent, you know, when it came out in America. And, you know, he was the first Australian actor as well. So this is why I go down the route of saying he's Australian, to be given over $1 million for a film.
Yeah.
Which hadn't been done up until that point.
Because I know I was watching a load of stuff for a pot round. He said he had to force his Australian accent on him because he had a proper New York twang.
Yeah.
He was getting sort of a bit bullied and a bit, you know, a bit ribbed at school because he had that twang. So he sort of picked up the Australian accent as quick as he could, just to not get bullied for it, which I think is quite cool because you know him for that Australian accent, like how strong it was in his earlier career.
Yeah, Yeah. I mean, he hit the ground running with his acting career. So he's a graduate of the National Institute of Dramatic Arts, where we was chatting just before we started. He was in the same class as Jeffrey Rush.
Housemates for a while as well.
Two very different careers.
Yep.
And I don't mean this in a bad way. I don't mean this in a bad way, but Mel Gibson looks good for his age. Uh-huh. If you are in the same class as Jeffrey Rush, who, yeah. I mean, obviously most people know from Pirates of the Caribbean, I would have thought, but... yeah, I mean, I wouldn't have thought they were in the same year. No. So after that, Mel Gibson, after doing some TV performances, some short films and such, his technically his first film is a film called Summer City, which I have the unfortunate pleasure of seeing. I've seen it before. I got it. Remember when you used to get a newspaper and you used to get like the TV guide in it?
Yeah.
And then on the back of the TV guide, back in the day, you could get like 4 DVDs for 15 quid.
Yeah.
Well, Summer City popped up and I was like, oh my God, I need that one. Because I hadn't got it on VHS when I was collecting on video. And I got it. And he is a bit part in it. I think his character name is like Scallop or something.
Scallop,
yeah. So yeah, he's like the surfer dude in it.
Yeah.
Bleach blonde hair. Not a great first performance. But then what happens in 1979, something amazing. Two films come out from Mel Gibson. One being Mad Max, which gave him critical worldwide fame. And the other one being the film Tim. Mm. And Tim is the one that in his home, well, at the time, homeland Australia, he won like an Australian Institute of Film Award, which is the equivalent of the Oscars, but in Australia.
But in Australia, yeah.
So two very different dramatic performances for Mad Max and Tim. And then from there, it goes on to... you look at a film like The Bounty, where he was his first American film with Sir Anthony Hopkins. Again, not a great film.
Well, that was a fair few years later. It was 5 years later.
Yeah, that's the film that kind of like then took him into the American cinema.
Well, it's Mad Max 2 sort of took him over there, wasn't it? It was Mad Max 2 where he picked up that fame
over
there.
Yeah, and then it wasn't really until 1987 when he comes out with Lethal Weapon that he became a household name. And then it was, you know, at that point, everyone knows who Mel Gibson is. He's, you know, the kind of the new guy on the scene, if you like. From then, we've already mentioned so many, but a whole slew of great films from, as we were saying, the Lethal Weapon saga, the four films there, right the way through to Chicken Run, Ransom, Patriot, Miss Soulful. I mean, I could list all of these. A Year of Living Dangerously. We've had Tim. We could go with...
I did not know he was in Pocahontas.
Pocahontas is the voice of John Smith. That. Yeah. Just the voice of John Smith.
Casper.
Casper, right. So three cameo films that he's in. Casper's one of them. Most people miss that. The scene where Bill Pullman's looking in the mirror and when he lifts his head up, he is Mel Gibson. Second time he lifts his head up, he's Clint Eastwood. And the third time he pops his head up, he's the Tale from the Crypt Keeper guy.
Yeah.
And then Dan Aykroyd makes his cameo shortly afterwards. He also cameoed in a film called... Fairy Tale. Now, this, so when I was on my Mel Gibson kind of, getting everything, I got this film Fairy Tale and I was like, where is he? Where's Mel Gibson? Fairy
Tale. What sort of year are we looking at?
95, 96?
Oh, no, Fairy Tale, earlier, a true story. Yeah.
And
yeah, 897.
97. All right. So he appears in the closing scene. I had to watch all of this fucking film.
Is it bad?
It's about this little girl who believes in fairies, that kind of thing. Her dad's away at war and everyone believes him to be dead. The closing scene is it's late at night and the dad returns home from war, picks up his daughter, and then the camera moves up and it's Mel Gibson.
Yes!
End.
Yes!
And I was like,
yes!
I watched the whole film for that.
Yeah, but still... Father returns home, war hero, Mel Gibson.
Mel Gibson. That's who you want. So Mel Gibson, Fairy Tale, Casper, and then the other one is Father's Day, which is this quite weird comedy with Billy Crystal and Robin Williams. And this woman appears to both Billy Crystal and Robin Williams and says, we have a daughter, but I don't know who the dad is. It's one of you two. But that's
I'm sure I've seen this.
Yeah,
film.
That's not the point. The point is she's gone missing and I need you two to track her down. So Billy Crystal and Robin Williams have to work together to find a daughter, not knowing if they are the dad, the biological dad or not. And Mel Gibson appears again in like the last kind of 15 minutes. It all boils down to them going to this music festival and he's a body piercer.
Scott the body piercer. But
yeah, and he's just like, and Billy Crystal just looks at him and goes, do they hurt like, about his piercings? And he's like, not the ones in the face. that's like his only line. So I could tell you his cameos as well as that. Obviously his directorial films, but we haven't even talked about things like, Payback, mm-hmm. 99. That was an epic film that was. You've already mentioned things like The Beaver, Patriot, just so many. Hamlet, Forever Young, Air America, where he started, you know, becoming friends with Robert Downey Jr., which he then later, what was that, Singing Detective, again, where he, you know, appears with Robert Downey Jr. So many films.
Have you seen that that little 3-minute video of where Robert Downey Jr. sort of intros him on stage? And he's talking about when Mel Gibson pulled him out of his alcoholism. So he lived with Mel Gibson for a little while. Mm. It's really, really good. Check it out on YouTube. He stands on stage and it's the typical Robert Downey Jr., you know, just suave as fuck. And he's just saying, you know, he told me, and he does this amazing speech. He told me that I have to pull the ugliness out of myself. He says, he calls it hugging the cactus, and you hug the cactus. And if you do it long enough and you really like embrace the ugly side of you, you can become a better person. And he says, you know, he took him under his, he made sure he was in work. He made sure he had food. He had a roof over his head. Mel Gibson did all of this for Robert Downey Jr. And he says, the only thing I want back from you is you pass this on. You do this for somebody else. And he says, he's standing on stage, this is after all of his shit. And he goes, who would have thought it'd be me doing it for him?
Yeah. And I mean, in this film, Singing Detective, I think, I haven't seen it for a long time. I've only seen it once, but I'm pretty certain Mel Gibson plays the therapist in that film.
Yeah.
Dr. Gibbon or something like that.
Dr. Gibbon.
Fucking hell, mate. I can name him all night. And then obviously Mel Gibson's directing career. So most people think of him as, let's go straight to it, Passion of the Christ. Mm-hmm. You know, the kind of controversial retelling of the, you know, the Last Days of Christ. But Braveheart, the one where he won the Oscar, which also won Best Film that year in 96. Man Without a Face, however, the earlier, his first directorial film, I actually thought was a really good piece. And I'm not going to pretend it's a perfect film. It's riddled with issues, but as a piece of filmmaking, it's just a good story. Mm-hmm. So, you know,
I've never seen that one.
Very young Nick Stahl, and he plays a half disfigured. Kind of ironically, he looks like Two Face. So half his face is burnt off. He's this school teacher, inspired by true stories. This kind of reclusive school teacher who takes under his wing a young. Kind of a guy who's got a good heart, but he's being pulled down the wrong way from the people he's hanging around with. This kind of reclusive school teacher takes him under his wing, starts giving him some private lessons because he sees something in him. But there's the controversy around how he got his scars, and there's this backstory, and it's got elements of things like, you know, like Frankenstein, because of how he lives and how he hides and how you don't really see him. It's got that kind of underpinning kind of nasty horror to it, but it's a really good family drama.
Did he direct this or did he write as
directed
well?
Directed this one, yeah. Okay. I don't think he did the screenplay, but I always thought that was a good film that mm-hmm. didn't get the credit it deserved.
Yeah.
And then obviously, as we know, Hacksaw Ridge, which he's directed, and Apocalypto.
Now, I didn't think he had his name to that.
He didn't at the time because he was being, I could be
wrong.
Was he
in trouble at the time?
Well, this is still the aftermath. We are in a solid Me Too era.
Yeah, of
Mel course. Gibson brings out a film that is being tipped to potentially be an Oscar nom. I'm not sure whether they changed it for its theatrical release, but at the time when it was being pre-screened, it was only at the end of the film did it say directed by Mel Gibson.
Okay.
So people wouldn't go into the film with that. I mean, most people in Hollywood would have known that he was directing
of
the
course,
film anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
And I like Hacksaw Ridge. I think out of his directing films, I don't think he's his best, but I
love that film. I really, really love that film.
I like Andrew Garfield.
I just think it's a great story. Mm. I think I love it. I absolutely loved it.
Andrew Garfield has a line in that I still use to this day. And that is, it's the line where he says, with so many people content on destroying the world, I don't think there's anything wrong in someone wanting to put it back together. And I think that's just a wicked line, a really good line.
He is ace in that film, isn't he?
Yeah, Vince Vaughn's great in that film.
Yeah, he is.
Vince Vaughn is absolutely amazing in that film. I'm just going to address the elephant in the room right now. If there's some pitter-pattering, we are recording...
Pitter-pattering, rustling.
We recorded my ass this week, and I have a dog called Reggie, and he's...
He's a gorgeous boy. Let's put a picture up.
He normally falls asleep by this time of the day, and he I think because we're talking, he's trying to figure out why we're talking.
He's excited. Sam's here with beer. He knows his playtime.
His playtime. So IMBD, 65 acting credits, as we've already said, won an Oscar for his directing in the film Braveheart. Trademarks, I thought this is brilliant. If you ever go on IMDb and look at, if you go into like trivia and you go into things like trademarks, these are Mel Gibson's trademarks as defined by his fans. Often acts and directs stories involving an individual who is persecuted and fights for justice. That's mega true.
Yeah, oh, massively.
Often portrayed as a widower in films such as Mad Max and its sequels, Lethal Weapon, Braveheart, Signs. Patriot, Signs, Edge of Darkness. Edge of Darkness was a weird film as well. Mm. Often portrays men who seek revenge for the murder of a friend or a family. Rugged, chiseled features, rich, gravelly voice, piercing blue eyes, often plays angry or deranged characters, and is known for an intense acting style. And I think that's pretty solid.
Extremely intense.
Yeah. I've also added on here, also known for playing pilots. Because he plays pilots quite a lot. Bird on the Wire, Air America, Forever Young, Ransom. He's an aviator at heart, I believe.
And let's be honest, he did it once, but he'll always be known for eating and crying at the same time. That beer goes back down, my friend.
Glad you brought that up. Eating and crying. I still think to this day that is the hardest thing for any actor to do.
It's been said, hasn't it? A lot of people said, like, you can't eat and cry.
Some of the greats say, it's you can eat and cry. It's trying to break down whilst eating is the difficult bit. So if you're crying...
he breaks down eating mashed potatoes, my friend.
And he didn't even order the mashed potatoes. He ordered a cheeseburger in that film. But it's just, in cinema, I can't remember who said it. I've got to figure it out. But some acclaimed actors, like, the hardest thing you can do is when a director wants you to eat, and as you're eating, you start to break down. And then I think literally like 2 days later, I saw signs. I was like, oh my God.
He don't just break down. He goes from naught to 100 as well, don't he? He's like eating his shit, like, eat your dinner.
He is intense. He is intense. Only outdone by Rooney Mara in A Ghost Story when she demolishes a whole chocolate pie.
Oh, I still need to watch that film. It's still on my list.
She devours that pie. What I've wanted to do as well is to start to talk about some of the awards that Gibson's won, other than the Oscar, obviously. Mm-hmm.
Is anyone the one?
Well, he's been nominated for, obviously, he's nominated for Hacksaw Ridge. Braveheart won the Best Picture, so I suppose he was obviously integral for that.
But he was, wasn't he nominated 3 times? It was picture, director, and lead actor.
Possibly.
Male actor. I'm sure it was.
Sexiest male alive. Numerous years. I mean, right from 85, he was winning. He was in like the top 50 sexiest men alive. Top 50 beautiful list. Forbes top 50 list. Most powerful men in Hollywood list. One of the highest paid actors of all time. Again, Australia's highest paid actor. First actor to be paid over 1 million. These are obviously all awards he won before 2005. Mm-hmm. 2006 onwards, very hard to find an award that he's won for, other than EDA Female Focus Awards. Sexiest Pig Award.
Sexiest Pig?
I mean, he beat Michael Bay this year. So. I'm not going to go into it now, but I'm not sticking up for Gibson. We said that at the very top of the episode. I can't stress this enough. Not condoning his actions or anything, or even a supporter of what he's done. I'm not glorifying it at all. But you can't really have an award called Sexiest Pig from the Female Focus Awards. I mean, if the shoe was on the other foot... A lot of people would have an opinion about
there'd
that.
There'd be a lot of angry people. Yeah, I agree. I totally agree.
But okay, so let's address the issues then. Mel Gibson's jaded past.
Let's say his naughty stage.
Because I think that's not giving it enough justice. Because we can't dumb it down. I mean, it was serious stuff. I mean, starts in the early 2000s where he's done for DUIs. What do you do when you get done for a DUI, Sam?
Well, if I was to get done for a DUI, which wouldn't happen because I would never sit inside a car and drink, but I would apologise. Mm-hmm. Male or female officer, I would respect them and I would have no racial views about anything.
No.
What would you do?
I know what I wouldn't do.
What wouldn't you do, Aaron?
When I'm being released from the prison, I wouldn't say thanks, sugar tits, to the female arresting officer.
No, you wouldn't.
Yeah, because what Gibson found out is that gets you another night in the slammer. And at the time as well, he was also heard making comments to a male officer, which were remarked as anti-Semitic remarks.
That really hit him hard when that got in the press.
I think we can quote it as well. Quote, Mel Gibson was that Jews are responsible for all the world wars or world tragedies.
Something like that, yeah.
I think there was already a suspicion of Mel Gibson's homophobic or what was suspected homophobic behaviour mm-hmm. up until now. I think this was the breaking point for him. That then, obviously, a few years later, as he released Passion of the Christ, this controversy reemerges itself. Passion of Christ is a weird one. So, yes, he put $25 million of his own money
into money. But then again, when you're worth $1.2 billion.
Yeah. And, well, at the time, yeah, obviously, yeah. And he'd been writing the script or kind of thinking of how he was going to do the screenplay as early back as, he says, 1992. So this has been on his mind for a long time. But no one else in Hollywood in 2006 or whatever it was, or 2000, was it 2004? I think he started the production on the film.
On Passion of the Christ.
On Passion of Christ, yeah. No one else in Hollywood at that time could be like, right, I need a load of money to go make a film about Jesus, retelling his last days, and I'm going to do it all in Latin. And the only people I'm going to hire need to be, you know, fluent in Latin. They need, you know, this isn't a, you know, this isn't hiring Robert Powell to be Jesus. This is like actually, you know, those that believe in the faith themselves, believe in the story themselves. No one else in Hollywood at that time probably could have got away with, yeah, all right, we'll finance that.
Yeah.
Even though Gibson put 25 of his own in, you know, the rest of the money that he needed at the time is just, yeah, no one else could have done that, I don't think.
No, I really don't think so. Let's just have a quick look, see if I can see how much it cost to make. No, it doesn't say, unfortunately.
So, like I say, for so his remarks that he's that he got in trouble for, then releasing Passion of Christ, which I don't think it did any favors to, you know, to religious communities across the world. Then obviously came his very public divorce at the time to his, his kind of childhood.
Yeah, 22 years from my life, well over two decades.
Yeah.
They were together, they had seven kids together.
Yeah, Robin.
Robin, yeah.
Yeah, so there was the divorce there, which at the time had the biggest ever settlement for a divorce, mm-hmm. a Hollywood divorce. He took 50% of his profits at the time, or his income. He then meets a younger lady.
A month later.
Yeah.
So it was a very, very public divorce, wasn't it? And obviously, there was all over the news of how much money was in it, the seven kids, everything. And then a month later, he comes out with this...
Like Russian 21-year-old.
Young, stunning Russian...
Oksana something or another,
musician.
Was she a ballet dancer?
Was it ballet dancer? Yeah, it might have been. And she was already pregnant with his child, wasn't she?
And then... and obviously then they...
Oksana Grigorievna.
Oksana.
Yeah.
Oksana.
And she's a Russian singer-songwriter.
Oh, singer-songwriter.
And pianist.
Oh, that's right, because I think she did some of the music to one of the films in, I think.
Oh, really?
The one we talked about, Edge of Darkness.
Okay.
I think she did some of the music in that. I think she's accredited as one of the songwriters.
Oh,
in that.
Sweet.
They have a kid together, and then the massive blow to Gibson for acting like an absolute tool. It was
a massive blow.
That's bad.
Listen, it's not a joke. It wasn't. Yeah. He hit her.
He hit her. Yeah, yeah. And then got drunk. I mean, Gibson's had a whole career of a whole history of kind of alcoholic abuse, hasn't he?
And, oh, massively, yeah.
And stuff, and it all boils down to him obviously assaulting his then at the time girlfriend, and then there was a recorded message of him threatening her over the telephone, threatening the.
This was all in a year. Like she gave birth, didn't she?
Yeah.
And this was all in a year's period as well.
And that got out. And then really Mel Gibson at this point was toxic. No, you couldn't touch him. And the guy goes into hiding for 10 years, only to reemerge, like I say, with films like The Beaver, Daddy's Home 2.
Which I do like.
Daddy's Home 2?
Yeah. Mm. I love both them films, but I was so excited when I saw him in that.
Yeah. And it's really weird, isn't it? Because I think, and again, this isn't to make a joke, or it's just an observation that, I mean, it's terrible that he's done those things and that, you know, someone's been victim of those actions at any time. Had it been now, there is no coming back.
No way.
Which is a good thing, which I suppose it shows how far we've come, mm-hmm. and definitely how far the film industry's come and, you know, what the Me Too movement has done. But had that been now, he is untouchable. I know the guy owns a bloody island off the coast of Japan or something, doesn't he? He has to go into hiding at this point. It's miraculous that after 10 years he can come back with films like Hacksaw Ridge and stuff like that. And I wouldn't say forgiven. I don't think it's ever going to be at that stage.
It's a problem. I don't think you can be forgiven for actions as such, but all you can do is try and regain the little bit of sort of self preservation you have and put it out there and be like, okay, I've made these mistakes. And, you know, a big thing about society is you can't just point constantly. You have to forgive at some point to a certain extent.
Well, you work in the prison service. Don't, when you release a prisoner at the end of their sentence, don't you say all is forgiven as they walk out?
A bit of that, yeah.
Is that what happens? That's...
yeah, no, not the jail I work at, mate. Not the jail I work at. We say see you in a week.
I do. We haven't even talked about the fact that he was in Expendables 3 and was probably the best thing in that film.
He was.
Machete Kills. Oh, that, have you seen that?
No, wasn't he in something called... Well, Machete Kills, no, I haven't. No,
Machete
no, no.
Kills is brilliant. It's that kind of B-movie.
It's a Danny Trejo film.
Danny Trejo
it?
Film. It's obviously a sequel to Machete.
Did he do a My Summer Vacation or something? Was it something
yeah,
like that? Or,
yeah.
I just remember the picture. He's got a flowery shirt on with a white vest.
It's got two names, that film, because I think it was originally released as Get the Gringo.
That was it. Yes, it was. It got re-released. When it first came out.
Yeah, they got re-released as
How I Spent My Summer Vacation.
Yeah, so in England, that's what it's called. On Netflix, that's what it's called. Yeah, that's a film where he's in a Mexican prison.
Yeah.
And God almighty.
And he just gets guns.
Do I not want to be in a Mexican prison? Jesus. He's in Bloodfather as well, which came out in 2016. That's really good.
I thought that was very similar. The posters look very similar.
Yeah. Bloodfather is a really weird one because it is a B movie action film.
Uh-huh.
And he does play that kind of, it's almost like a kind of mirror to his lifestyle, you know, with the character that he plays, mm-hmm. you know, and it's got Michael Parks in it as well.
Is it really?
Who plays a very red state Michael Parks in this as well.
Oh, God.
You know, he's like a Nazi kind of supporter.
Love red state
still.
Michael Parks.
Yeah, he's very much like that still in it. And then obviously last year's Dragged Across Concrete, which I haven't seen, but I hear is nothing but a slow burner, but the payoff's pretty good, isn't mm-hmm. it? I was just looking at this because, it was Edge of Darkness was the film that brought him back after his long time off and out of the spotlight where he took 10 years away. And then obviously the controversy starts again with his actions. Not forgiven by any standards, but has repeatedly apologised. We believe is now at a stage where he is in a better mindset and is at least acknowledging his behaviour and is accountable for his behaviour. Again, does not doesn't forgive him for what he's done.
I'm sure I saw or read somewhere that I think he donates or volunteers or something for these sort of charities around his actions. I'm sure I read that somewhere.
Yeah. So hopefully he's on he's on a better track and everyone involved is okay and in a better place.
Agreed. And he keeps his head down as well, doesn't he? He hasn't got that egotistical side to him anymore.
Now, before we get on to the top five films of ours, let's look at some of the roles that Mel Gibson has turned down over the years. Mel Gibson was originally signed on to play Wolverine before Hugh Jackman got it.
It would have been interesting, but you can't replace him.
He's got that, because Mel Gibson's what, 5'9"? Mm-hmm. So he's not huge. And the Wolverine character in the comics was always a bit shorter than all the others, wasn't he?
He was a Wolverine.
He was like that kind of honey badger style, kind of vicious person. So he's got the kind of build. And Mel Gibson is pretty big. If you see him in We Were Soldiers, the guy's tanked. And Expendables 3, he put on a bit of timber for that as well. But We Were Soldiers, opening scene in that, mate, where he's brushing his teeth and you're like, oh, guns on this guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, so he turned down the role of Wolverine. He also turned down the role of 1989's Batman.
That's insane.
But this was before Tim Burton was signed onto the project. This was when Richard Donner, who did Lethal Weapon, was originally signed up to do Batman and Gibson was his first choice.
Of course, which you would be after Lethal Weapon.
Of course, yeah. He was also in the running for the main part, Kevin Costner's role in The Untouchables, which... I mean, the problem with The Untouchables is not who was cast. It was Sean Connery's accent.
You can't blame him for that accent.
I want to say Norwegian. I don't know what that accent is. He turned down the role of Harvey Dent in Batman Forever.
Again, insane.
Which is the reference.
Fuck it, the next Batman.
Oh, geez.
After Robert Pattinson.
Yeah. I mean, could you imagine? Yeah, turning down Batman and then turning down Two-Face. Two-Face,
the new Batman with a big fucking beard.
Batman, he turned down the Batman Harvey Dent to do Braveheart. So, although I've got issues with that film, probably the smarter choice than Batman Forever.
Maybe a little bit, mate.
Turned down the lead role in World Trade Center that Nicolas Cage then took on.
Now, I never saw that film.
No, I didn't really enjoy it.
But I think it was one of a stream of films about the Trade Center at the time. But I think this was once with the biggest cast, wasn't it?
Yeah, I read this. I was reading this blog earlier, and so if I remember who it was, I'll give credit to it on Twitter. Basically, saying how far it's like the when is it okay to do a film after a tragedy? You know, whether it be...
I've heard this on a podcast. I'm sure it was Tell Him Steve Dave or something Kevin Smith did.
Whether it be a, you know, a serial killer, obviously the Ted Bundy film that came out earlier this year, I suppose, was a big catalyst for this conversation. You know, whether it be Holocaust, whether it be wars, I did think at the time, bringing out a film in 2006 around the World Trade Center was too soon.
It wasn't. My God, we was absolutely saturated with them. They were all over the place. We had indie films of it. We had major films of it, but we had so many documentaries about it. I get it. It is the biggest modern tragedy in American history. I totally agree with that. Nothing against that. But yeah, absolutely. Let the dust settle.
Yeah.
Like now or a few years ago, maybe, but that was quick. And to get it with Nicolas Cage on it. You can't get Cage rage on something like that.
It did feel a bit too soon, didn't it? Yeah, so there's some of the films that Mel Gibson's turned down. So let's start looking at then our top five Mel Gibson films. Now, I think people are going to disagree with these.
I totally agree with you. People disagree with these. But actually, me and Aaron, I think four and five was the other way around. We came up with a list pretty much exactly the same, didn't we? Our list was very similar.
In at number five on the Mel Gibson top five list from Sorry You're My Seat, it's 2000's Chicken Run.
Yes, it is.
Yes. I
wanted it at number four, but I'll accept number five.
I love Nick Park. I love stop animation. I love claymation. I love Wallace. I love all of that stuff.
Let's be honest. People still to this day for now and then get a cheeky chicken run reference in. I don't like gravy. We all say it.
I don't want to be a pie because I don't like gravy.
Exactly.
Chicken Run. Chicken Run is our fifth film. I didn't see this at the cinema.
No, I didn't.
But I definitely got it on DVD when it came out. And yeah, just absolutely love that film. Absolutely love that film. In at number four is a personal favourite, and that is Ransom.
Mm-hmm.
So Ransom's a remake of the 1954 film that starred Glenn Ford. It's directed by Ron Howard. If you haven't seen this film, Mel Gibson's son gets kidnapped in Central Park. And so it's all based in New York. He plays this character. Mel Gibson plays this character called Tom Mullen, who's this rich millionaire who owns a kind of airplane company. And the kidnappers obviously hold the son ransom. The twist in the film is, again, spoilers, most people have seen it's 96. It's halfway through the film. Mel Gibson goes on national TV and says, instead of giving the kidnappers the million or the 3 million, what they're asking for, I'm going to turn it on its head and I'm going to give whoever turns you in the 3 million.
That was another level when that happened.
Stares down the camera and he's like, do you know anyone that wouldn't turn your ass in for 3 million?
Yeah. And that scene makes you just jaw drop, doesn't it?
It's that kind of cat and mouse game where all of a sudden the tables are completely turned.
Yeah.
And the second half of the film is just completely different. And it's then it becomes this focus on, could you do that? Because you're actually endangering your son as, you know, way more, because now it makes more sense for the bad guys to kill and run,
yeah, absolutely. You know?
And it's just got some intense scenes, amazing supporting cast, Delroy Lindo, podcast favourite in this film, Gary Sinise.
Love a bit of Gary Sinise.
Yeah, Donnie Wahlberg's in it. It's just, it's a brilliant film. I really enjoyed it. Again, not without its flaws, just an enjoyable piece of cinema.
Who
from
played the kidnappers?
Gary Sinise was the main one, yeah.
He was Gary Sinise.
Donnie Wahlberg was the kind of young one, didn't really know what he was doing. And Liv Schreiber, I think, is the other one. Donnie Wahlberg's brother in that. I'm trying to remember who his wife was in that film. It wasn't Helen Hunt. I think she starred with him in What Women Want.
Yeah, it was.
It was who starred... was it René Russo who starred with him in Lethal Weapon 4?
It was. René Russo, yeah.
God, René Russo. What an amazing... Do you know René Russo is one of
the actors? Yeah, it was Luke Shriver as well, yeah.
Yeah, René Russo is one of them where I was like, oh my God, I didn't realise how much I missed René Russo until I saw Nightcrawler.
Yes.
And then I was like, where have you been all this time? Yeah. Like, amazing. Sorry, moving on down the list. So five, Chicken Run. Four, Ransom. Number three... Mad Max 2.
Now, this is one I haven't seen. I think I spoke about this on a very earlier episode. I owned them on DVD. I think I got them off Chibs, bought them off Chibs when he was doing a bit of a clear out. So I watched the first one and I just didn't love it.
Mm.
Like, I enjoyed it, but I didn't love it. And for some reason, I thought Mad Max 1 was supposed to be the tits. Obviously, I'd seen Fury Road at this point, so I never went on and finished. I was absolutely knackered. I was on nights. Finished first one. I never saw two or three.
Yeah. Two is much better. Two is one of them rare times where a sequel surpasses the original.
Yeah.
Mad Max 1 is good, and it's that post-apocalyptic world.
It's not overly post-apocalyptic.
No, it's just Australia.
It's just Australia with some weird-looking guys and weird, fucked up.
It's just the ending of that film, I think, was really great. Well, there's a couple of scenes in there were a bit brutal, I think, at the time, in whatever it was, 79. You know, particularly the end of the film where he's got the bad guy, again, spoilers, but so cool. He's got the bad guy chained to like a burning motorbike or whatever it is, burning car.
He's such a dickhead, that bad guy as well.
Yeah, he's like the sleaze, isn't he? And he's like, he said it'll take the car's going to blow up. It'll take 10 minutes to cut through the chain, five through your ankle or whatever.
Yeah.
That just ends the film. And it had that, like, it could have been great. And the reason why I'm putting Mad Max 2 ahead of that is in the third position is because I feel that Mad Max 2 went to that next level that Mad Max 1 was just a little bit afraid to do.
Mm-hmm.
George Miller's a great director. And I feel in Mad Max 2, they built the audience, and it was in this film that they went, right, let's go for it. A couple of characters in that film die that you do not think are going to die, including mm-hmm. his dog, you know, and stuff like that. And there's a female character in it, a female lead, and you think she's safe? No, she's not safe.
No one's safe, my friend.
Yeah, and it just had that real apocalyptic feel to it. And it's more action-y. So again, when you look at films like, you know, Aliens versus Alien and people that like Terminator 2 over Terminator 1, mm-hmm. this was definitely for the action nut.
Yes,
you know,
yes,
the action
yes.
fan. Mad Max 2 is it's just, it's great. It's simple, and but it's that, it's a film, I love this quote, it's a film that leaves dirt under your fingernails. It's just that kind of film.
Yeah, I'm going to watch this film before we take up season 2. We'll have a bit of a chat about
Mad Max 2 is a good watch, and I think it holds up. I said the other week, I watched it like, we've been out till about 5 in the morning, and then we got home and I had to be up the next day to look after someone's dog. So 8 in the morning, I had 3 hours sleep, I was still tanked. I was still, you know, like when you wake up, you're like, I'm still drunk. I was just monged on the sofa watching Mad Max 2. In at number 2, now, we've been cheeky. We've put in one of his directorial films.
We have.
In not one of his acting films. No, it is not. It is not Hacksaw Ridge. It is not Man Without a Face. It's not The Passion of the Christ.
It's not Braveheart.
And it's definitely not Braveheart.
Which I think everyone's expecting.
Oh, I don't like Braveheart.
I don't like it. I know you don't.
I like the score to Braveheart. The music's beautiful in that film.
You dressed up as Braveheart.
I did.
You dressed up as William Wallace.
No, for me, I can't like a film with the script writer who says, oh, I only researched William Wallace after I wrote the film.
It's so fucking historically incorrect, isn't it? But, bless him.
But no, for us, in number 2 is Apocalypto.
Yes.
The 2006 movie. Talking about a film that leaves dirt under your fingernails, this film leaves blood in your mouth. It is nasty.
This is a film because it's all. What do you call it? Subtitled.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is not the sort of film. If you listen to our very, very early episodes, boobs, gore, Sam, just into the action and just watching a film. This was, I think, the film for me that I watched and just went, shit, there is something different out there.
Mm.
And I remember this being my film for years and years and years, saying, when people said, what's your favourite film? I said this film, purely just because I was watching something completely different. And it was so gritty, so gory, so disgusting in a way, which was very me. I don't want to use the words tastefully done, but done into a completely different vein to what I used to watch.
For me, it's like films like The Revenant, where it's okay that it crosses a graphic line because The Revenant
is done in a different way. Yeah.
It's done in a different way that also has a narrative strong enough for me to kind of, this is why I want to see Midsommar. And I don't like horror films. I know it's been described as a psychological thriller, but I don't like films that are gore for the sake of gore. I think Apocalypto has such a strong narrative in it and characters that, I mean, talk about film being a portal to another world. I know fuck all about Mayan culture, anything like that. And again, this goes,
really?
And this goes down to Mel Gibson again, isn't it? 2004, I'm going to do Passion of Christ in Latin. 2 years later, I need more money. Mel, you've caused
mayhem. We've not got enough money. What you got this time?
I want to do a film about the Mayan tribes and I need even more money. I'm going to do it in subtitles again.
And if you think the last one didn't give me enough shit, wait till you see this bad boy.
Apocalypto, he come out quite well in this because he gave a lot of the props, he gave a lot of the materials that they made for the film to he left him over there, didn't he?
Yes.
So he donated all just about everything that they made for the film. Apocalypto is, it's a long slog. I mean, we are talking nearly 3 hours, this movie.
Stunning though. And I tell you what, you watch it, you don't realise it's 3 hours long.
No. And it is heart in your mouth stuff. It's just, you know, it packs a punch, that movie. I've only ever seen it once, but because it's one of the films I don't want to watch again. I was like, Jesus, that was intense.
It gets you enough the first time. I've only ever seen it once, and I will rewatch it. But I think for me, especially now, like, I wouldn't rewatch it back then because of how long it was. Now I'm worried of how I'd feel about it.
Yeah.
Like, films I disliked back then, I want to rewatch to see how I'd feel about it now. Now I have a different taste in my mouth for film. But this, I worry a little bit how I'd feel about it.
I hope it doesn't age bad.
I don't think it will.
In fact, you're saying we're not going to go into it in too much. The scene where they're given their freedom if they can get to the end of that kind of like arena.
Yeah.
So they're told if you run, you know, you can, and you get to the end, your freedom's there, but they start firing arrows at them. And also there's a dude with a club halfway down who's just like got it out for you and your hands are tied behind your back or whatever. That scene, dude, I was like edge of my seat. I was like, run, Forrest. I just fucking peg it.
Oh, mate, let's do it. Let's rewatch this. If we do it together, we're safe.
Yeah, intense film. So, Rundown before I reveal number one. Most people are going to guess what it is already. Chicken Run, number 5. Ransom, number 4. Mad Max 2 at number 3. Apocalypto at number 2. And then, obviously, number 1, 1987, career-defining role as Martin Riggs in Lethal Weapon.
That is home to... Oh, what? Lethal Weapon, my friend. How could it not be? Let's be perfectly honest. If anyone, and please get in contact, please talk to us, please message us, Facebook, Twitter. If you didn't have Lethal Weapon as number one, why? What did you have? I want to know.
What was wrong with your childhood?
Yeah, exactly. Just explain to us, what did you think was better than Lethal Weapon? I'd love to.
Do you think millennials will appreciate Lethal Weapon?
Yes.
I think they will. I think it stands the test of time.
But then again, remember, millennials were born in we are millennials because millennials were born in 1984 onwards.
All right. Okay.
That's classed as a millennial. So.
All right. Do you think people that are born after 2000 will appreciate?
Them motherfuckers.
Do you think they will appreciate?
I think they would, yeah. I do, because buddy cop will never die.
So this is the thing. I it's a chalk and cheese cop movie.
Agreed.
And what I love about Lethal Weapon is that the case, the crime that they're investigating, the trying to take down a drug cartel that's moving into the LA area, all of that stuff is secondary to
their
relationship as two cops being forced together. The veteran cop who's just about to retire and the PTSD Vietnamese war veteran who is a loose end of his life, is suicidal, being paired together almost like the veteran cop has to babysit this rookie. Their relationship is what the film is. He's the lethal weapon.
I think it carries very modern day like problems in there as well. Like you know, the suicidal tendencies, mental health issues, the stuff like that, the grieving. I think it carries on so well. So it's stuff that we are very hot on these days. It had back then. And what year was Lethal Weapons?
87, mate.
87.
The best year ever. Yeah. Year when everything came out.
Yeah, it did. That's what your mama said.
That's right. This film is as old as I am. This film, I mean, we did a short piece for the Show Me the Podcast show where we talked about this.
Yeah, the last episode is very good.
And I'm just going to repeat myself. It is that iconic performance of Danny Glover and Mel Gibson in this film as Riggs and Murtaugh. There's just so many scenes in it. I said it in their show, and I'll say it again, the scene where he has to go up on top of the building to bring down the jumper, and he just says it so casually, he's like, I'll go get him, and he fucking jumps off wonders, the building yeah. with him. It's just iconic, that scene. Do you want to jump? Do you? Like, just absolutely brilliant, that whole bit. Gary Busey, just absolutely brilliant. You know, I don't even think he's acting, Busey.
Can you use the word Gary, like, can use that word for Gary Busey. Like,
acting.
Brilliant acting.
Yeah. Just,
he's another level, isn't he? He's flying.
Yeah.
He's,
what's his name? Mr. Joshua, isn't it?
Yeah. It's like, he's space charged, isn't he?
Yeah. That bit as well where he's like, where he's burning his arm with the lighter. I'm pretty certain he didn't know the camera was rolling.
No.
They just caught him. They just caught him off
Quick,
camera.
Film Gary.
Look what Gary's doing. You know, fucking mental. Yeah. It's just such a good film, right the way from, like I said, these big explosive sequences, right the way down to a scrap on the front lawn
which
at the end of the film.
Amazing.
It's so good. It's just a brilliant, brilliant movie in every aspect. It's flawless. Yeah. Gibson went on record to say that one of the hardest characters he's had to play because on the one hand, he's got the weight of him being a Vietnamese war vet, PTSD, he's got a responsible, and a policeman. So it's a very, you're representing a lot of people in that category.
Yeah, massively.
It's why I love going off topic. That's why I love the Punisher as a character, because the weight of that character, you have to play someone who's been a victim of domestic violence and losing his wife, he's
grieving,
a widow,
grieving,
PTSD, Marine, you've got such a weight in that character. And Riggs is the same.
Yeah, exactly. And to get that and to, it's so weird because to have a character like that, that you can see them stir into such vengeance. Now, vengeance is a great thing in a film, but if it's just pushed and go, oh, I am venging my friend here, it's bullshit. But when you actually see someone like Martin Riggs or the Punisher, as you'd have said, you see them turn this into what they get. And that scene on the lawn, it is another level. Like he is fighting. He's fighting for so much more. When you watch it, he's fighting for so much more than just the case.
I love it. It's brilliant. And one thing I did mention, a bit of pop trivia for this film as well, is that the first guy that he takes down when he's buying the drugs at the Christmas tree shop, like the guys that are selling the Christmas trees that are selling the drugs, and he busts them and it ends up in a shootout. The first person he shoots is Anthony Kiedis's dad, the singer from Red Hot Chili Peppers.
Is it really?
That's his dad. He's got a wicked name. His name's Blackie. He's got a really, really unique name. It's Blackie something.
I'll try to find it.
You see if you can find it. Lethal Weapon for me is the greatest film that Mel Gibson's ever produced. I'm going to go through some others that we hadn't done.
I mean, let's be perfectly honest. That picture right there, just
so them crazy goose eyes
look
that he's
at
got.
Right.
Yeah,
if you're watching, look at them crazy goose eyes. Look at
him. You know what crazy is, and then he starts slapping his own face, doesn't he? later on this year, he's got The Professor and The Madman coming out with Sean Penn. If I was a betting man and I was to say which one does Mel Gibson play, I wouldn't say The Professor.
Yeah, which is very strange.
But
yeah,
he does. Sean Penn is the madman in that film. We haven't obviously talked about films like Paparazzi, again, uncredited role in that. We have brushed upon things like Signs, We Were Soldiers, What Women Want. I mean, that film again, that was remade this year, wasn't it? But from the other way.
What Men Want. Apparently it was awful.
Oh, mate, Conspiracy Theory. That was a film with Patrick Stewart.
I never saw it.
Oh, I love that. Julia Roberts is in that film. I love that film. That was so good. I'm surprised that didn't make the top five. Conspiracy Theory, he's like I say, a paranoid, into conspiracy theories. And then lo and behold, he actually does come across a conspiracy that he gets thrown into. It's just a brilliant film.
What year is that?
Conspiracy Theory, 97.
Cool.
Just after Ransom. Obviously, we talked about Patriot, Million Dollar Hotel. That's a really weird one with Mila Jovovich in it. It's kind of more of an indie art house kind of film. He plays a detective in that one. It was okay. Pocahontas, Casper, Braveheart, Maverick. Maverick,
yes, boy.
The film inspired by the TV series that starred James Caan. James Caan is in this as Mel Gibson's dad in it. Jodie Foster appears in this film, lifelong friend of Mel Gibson, who then went on to direct The Beaver that Mel Gibson was in.
Did not know that.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Mel Gibson says his relationship with her is really honest because although they, in terms of their private lives, completely disagree with each other, she's atheist I think she's bisexual or lesbian. I'm not sure. God, don't quote me. Don't hate me. But Mel Gibson went on to say that obviously for two people that wouldn't have the same morals or views in life, they couldn't be more like in love with each other. Again, I'm very conscious that I might have misrepresented Jodie Foster there. So don't shoot me if I got that wrong. Man Without a Face talks about Forever Young. Hamlet.
Which I did forget about until I reread this.
Good. Yeah. Hamlet, which did they say at one time is the hardest character to portray on stage or on screen? It's Hamlet. Bird on a Wire with Goldie Hawn and Goldie Hawn. Tequila Sunrise was the other one I was going to say with Kurt Russell. I always thought if I ever had a boat, I'd call it Tequila Sunrise. and then his earlier career, like we said, we basically briefly talked about Miss Sofal, Bounty, Gallipoli, again another one that I think he won his second Australian Institute Award for, the equivalent of the American Oscars. I think he won the Australian Oscars. He won for that as well. Yeah, incredible career. Incredible career. Jaded personal life. But yeah, Mel Gibson. Did you find that guy's name?
I can't find it.
If not, I'm going to find it before we finish the show, because if not, people are going to think I'm weird for saying that someone's name is actually Blackie.
With Black, his mother, then
Blackie Dammit.
Blackie Dammit, is that his name, honestly?
Yeah, 1987.
You found that straight away?
Yeah, yeah, because I just typed in IMDb Blackie and he pops up.
Fuck, man.
Yeah, that is Anthony Kiedis' dad.
I actually went to Anthony Kiedis' thing and it says nothing other than, did not know that he lived in Lithuania. Yeah, interesting.
So, we've learned a lot today.
We have learned a lot today.
This is the first...
What a great topic to talk about. Let's be honest.
Yeah. I've enjoyed it. I've enjoyed my Gibson. Now, the second part of our mini-series, so the next episode, we have got a very, very special guest coming on. He is a good friend of the show, Kareem Mahfouz.
Disclaimer, we will be using him for a proper episode.
Well, I'm going to bring him on next week to test the waters with him.
Little chat, yeah.
See if we can contain him for a full episode.
See who he offends.
Yeah. The man of many voices, Kareem Mahfouz, incredibly funny bloke. We are going to look at some action films from the 80s. I think he wanted to do Lethal Weapon.
Did he? Do it.
If not, we'll do Predator or something like that. But we'll do an 80s throwback movie. He wanted to do Lord of the Rings trilogy, but we ain't got time to do that in a minute.
That'll be the main episode, yeah.
Yeah, that's what we'll get him on the main show for. And other than that, we are preparing season 2 of Sorry You're in My Seat. That'll be coming out very shortly. And then it's just on with the show, really.
Absolutely. Give us a couple of weeks. We want to get a big episode for episode 1. Oh, well, episode 53, but episode 1 of season 2. So we was going to be rushed to get something out to you. So we decided to take a break and actually just enjoy a little bit of time, enjoy movies again, instead of having to force some watches, just enjoy it and come back in fresh and strong.
Good. Well, this is Aaron signing off. If you don't, see you later. Good afternoon, good evening, good night.
Goodbye, everybody.